and welcome to Sipfa Speaks, the podcast for public finance professionals. In this edition, we're joined by Rod Penman, who is head of public sector at the insurer Zurich Municipal. He talks about the biggest risks that local authorities face and how cutting the cost of their insurance may be a red herring. Our other guest is Liz Sandwith, who's chief professional practices advisor at the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors. Sipfa's Viv Russell will be asking her why internal audit is so important and how it can help the public sector achieve its goals. I'm delighted to be joined by Rod Penman, who is head of public services at Zurich Municipal. Hi, Rod, and thanks for joining us today on Sipfa Speaks.
Hi, Mark. Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
So Zurich is a leading insurer with customers in the UK and across the whole world. It provides a range of services and insurance products across more than 210 countries. Could you tell us a little bit about your role as head of public services, Rod?
In essence, my role, which is UK-based, I only deal in the UK, not the global Zurich. My role is to oversee the Zurich Municipal proposition and strategy in relation to local government risk and insurance in the UK. I've also got an additional part of the role where I look after our approach to procurement across the whole of the public sector, not just local government. Most of my time is spent trying to ensure that I understand the public sector environment and what's happening, importantly, what's coming down the line at us, and ensuring then that the Zurich Municipal proposition is relevant and credible and continues to support the sector. I've been around the public sector risk and insurance arena for many years. One thing I would say at the moment, this current time is probably the most interesting time there's ever been, albeit it's really challenging. Essentially, it's making sure our proposition and strategy is relevant for the sector.
In terms of some of those challenges which you just touched on, would you be able to just outline those challenges to our listeners?
The pandemic has thrown up so many different challenges. The cost of living crisis, which I know we'll talk about, but also the change in dynamic, which we have in the private sector as well. We're trying to get people back to the office. What additional risks does that present? We've got the green agenda. That's thrown up all sorts of different risks, which local authorities have to get involved with, anaerobic digestion plants and things like that, which fill insurers with horror. But in terms of the green agenda, things that we have to learn to cope with, because that's going to be your world or the public sector world as we go forward. So lots and lots of challenges. Health and social care. I'm on a Sipfa podcast, so local government finance is clearly a significant concern area at the moment, because budgets under pressure, that inevitably means to more risk.
Thanks, Rod. So you just touched on the cost of living crisis in your previous answer. It's not just making headlines here in the UK, but also around the whole world. Cost pressures will be causing considerable challenges for public bodies and local authorities, just as they will private citizens all across the country. But as being part of a responsible public body, they still need insurance. Mm-hmm. Should they be looking at their insurance as one of the areas where they can cut costs and save money? Or is that a bit of a red herring?
Okay, that's a big question, that one. We recognise insurance is a big spend for public sector bodies, so it's right that it's scrutinised and reviewed to ensure that it does provide value for money. And in most cases, councils will tender every 3 to 5 years for their insurances to ensure the premiums market tested and to reflect effectiveness of the risk management within the council. But essentially, there's only two ways to reduce insurance costs. Or three, one could be to not insure at all. But number one is to take more of the risk yourself by virtue of self-insurance or a deductible. It's worth highlighting that the biggest insurers of insurance risk within the public sector world are local authorities themselves. Most, certainly upper tier authorities, will have significant self-insurance layers. So they are the biggest insurers. So that's something to take into account. The second way is by preventing claims from happening in the first place. So risk mitigation, or in its purest iteration, risk avoidance. But it's really difficult to avoid risk completely, but it's feasible to manage risk effectively, which many councils do achieve. So what insurers are looking for is a good picture of how you manage risk, and ultimately that tells them the likelihood of you having a claim. But it's inevitable that in a lot of areas of public sector risk, there will be claims. So it's really important to take out pound swapping, because the insurer is going to add profit and expenses to the look at the claims and then add a bit of profit and expenses. So if you know it's going to happen, then don't give the insurer profit. It sounds an odd thing to say, but it does make sense. It's more cost effective for councils to pay pay those claims themselves utilising an insurance fund or a provision. But the bit to insure is the uncertain costs, because that's what's going to damage your budget. So the first way to save money would be to eliminate the pound swapping. And then you need to consider your risk appetite. How much risk are you prepared to take, and what uncertainty is there in that? And what are the types of claims that are really going to damage the council's budget? And once you've established what you're comfortable with, then that's where you should set your level of self-insurance. So insure the uncertainty and retain the costs that you know are going to be certain. So if you can manage that self-insured cost down, so the big chunk that you're going to take yourself, if you can manage the cost there down, you get the savings directly. And that's an effective way of doing it. So, and the savings are likely to be at a level that's more than your insurance premium. So that if you can make your savings there, then you'll save far more money than you would trying to cut your insurance premium down. And just to give an example of that, an upper tier council may have an insurance fund of upwards of £10 million. So if you make a 5% saving on the costs within that, that's likely to be more than your insurance premium. Coming back to the question of the cost of living crisis, though, the cost of settling claims is affected by the same inflationary pressures that we're seeing. Supply chains have been disrupted, been well publicised, and that leads to increased costs. Try getting a builder on site at the moment, you know, for instance, it's really, really difficult. Or getting spare parts for vehicles has become a challenge. And that all leads to increased costs of settlement. Therefore, your self-insured costs are likely to rise unless you avoid the claim in the first place. Or if it's an insured claim, then the insurer's settlement costs are going to increase. And then they have to budget for that, which means that in the current climate, that's likely to be an increase in premium rather than a reduction. But if we go full circle to the argument that I started with, if you ensure that you properly manage risk and those who can demonstrate that they are will reap the benefits, but in the current climate, that's likely to mean less of an increase rather than a saving. The short answer to your question is, yes, it is a bit of a red herring to expect to generate savings from insurance premiums unless you're prepared to take on more self-insurance, or that you can evidence that you're managing risk and you're going to have less claims. But the double whammy for a council would be that if your risk management isn't right and you increase your self-insurance, it's likely to be false economy, because you're likely to be the combination of premium and self-insurance costs is likely to be more than you're paying at the moment. Might not be the answer people want to hear, but it's highly unlikely that there'll be savings in the current climate.
In that answer, you spoke about risk a lot. In your experience as an insurance provider, what are the three top risks that local authorities face?
Looking after properties. Local government's got some substantial properties, and you know, so making sure that buildings are secured and maintained properly and things like that. And come back to the cost of living crisis, that's a challenge. Bear in mind, you know, the budgetary pressures elsewhere. School fires is probably the one that gets the biggest publicity. You know, if you lose a school, you know, it's a significant cost, but it's the knock-on effect into the community. The additional cost of busing children around, of parents having to take their children to different schools, and just the sheer upset and for the community, because schools tend to be community hubs. You know, so if you lose a school, it's a building. The building can be replaced, but the knock-on effects are significant. The second one, children safeguarding, you know, that's an area that gets a lot of publicity. And, you know, we've had recent examples of children have been unfortunately killed or severely injured. That's a really difficult area to manage. Again, budgetary pressures and, you know, with regard to social services departments and being able to maintain your workforce in the current climate, that makes that a challenging risk, but can be really costly if a council gets it wrong. And then the third one is highways. In the press, we hear a lot about the pothole debate, you know, where cars are damaged and so on. But it's far deeper than that. And they, you know, maintain the highways at a level to protect the more vulnerable people on the highway, cyclists and motorcyclists. And now, of course, e-scooters, that also generates a huge debate. You know, hitting a pothole on a bike or a motorcycle, an e-scooter, causes significant damage to people. And so we do see some big claims in that area as well. But in terms of volume and severity, those would be the three key areas.
Thanks, Rod. When working with public bodies on their insurance needs, is there anything else which they need to consider which is specific to them being in a public sector? What other considerations, apart from cost, which we've just spoken about, should they be thinking about? And how can Zurich help them meet their needs and obligations?
Well, the main difference between the public sector and the private sector is that local authorities have risks which they have to deal with because of statutory duties and things like that. So there's risk imposed on them that they can't avoid. So they have to deal with it. But, you know, essentially, public liability claim in the public sector is the same as a public liability claim in the private sector. It just comes from a different place. But there are things that can't avoid, therefore you either have to manage them yourself or insure them. But apart from cost, rather than talk about insurance premiums, that how else can insurance work for you and try and mitigate your costs? You know, I talked before about self-insured claims and things like that. And if you save on your self-insured claims, you'll get a bigger saving. But what's often missed is that insurers' propositions can support council service delivery or council's own strategic plans and goals. But it rarely gets picked up. You know, insurance tends to be looked at as almost a homogenous product. You know, it's just insurance. But yet when you consider the supply chains that insurers have and things like that, and the things that they do, we could help in terms of council service delivery, which in turn could save on costs. And an example, you know, that would be, you know, anyone affected by a flood claim or something, you know, as we see regularly and even more regularly now. It's a traumatic event. People really suffer quite badly, both in their own personal economic circumstances, but mentally. Part of our proposition, and other insurers will do something similar. So, you know, this isn't a sales pitch, but we will provide counselling services. So, you know, so anyone who has a flood, we will automatically offer them a counselling service, but that will apply to a council house resident as well as to a private householder who's insured with Zurich. So how can that dovetail into the council's recovery plans or their support for residents? It's in the premium, so it's not going to cost any more, but it may well be able to impact on a local authority's costs. Rehabilitation is another one that I know councils have rehab nurses, as do we. And typically our rehabilitation proposition gets triggered by an employer's liability claim, so a council employee being injured. But there's no reason why it can't be triggered for, you know, for somebody who suffers an injury or mental trauma from a pavement trip or being injured in a council building or something along those lines. And if you're getting an injured person back towards normality, has financial implications. And, you know, if you take an elderly person who's gone over a footpath trip and maybe been hospitalised with a broken ankle or something like that, they may well have lived perfectly well on their own before then, but coming out of hospital have to access council services. Meals on Wheels or, you know, something along those lines. If we can help with rehabilitation, then potentially the savings to the social services budget. So, you know, somebody making a link between insurance and the social services budget it's very rare that it happens. We have a safer schools ecosystem. What that does is bring schools, teachers, parents and pupils together to try and keep the children safe online, you know, which is a big issue at the moment. And it's done through an app, but also training for teachers, safeguarding training. There's two things. It saves schools £2,500 to £3,000 per school on training because they can do the training online rather than have to go off site to do the safeguarding training. But at the same time, it helps children who may be in difficulty online, perhaps being groomed online and things like that. It can help them. But, you know, going back to that £2,500 to £3,000 per annum per school, that's probably equivalent to 20% of the insurance premium. So, you know, you can see it's a big cost, but quite often it's not linked to the insurance product by the council. So they're not achieving the savings. It also plays into things like good parenting and things like that. And most councils will have a target around good parenting and things like that. There's lots of ways that an insurer's proposition could impact on local authority costs, but they generally don't get looked at. People just look at what's the headline insurance premium, and that may be the cost of claims handling, and that's about it.
Cost shouldn't be the main driver, and you spoke about things being included in premiums. What does good value look like in the public sector?
For me, it's about ensuring the total costs, including the hidden costs, versus the benefits that you get beyond that, and how does the product or service that curing benefit the council beyond that service, and what additional benefits do the council get? And all too often in my world, that's, you know, it's only the headline price that's evaluated. But I believe councils are missing that, the benefits of what insurers and other service providers can deliver to help with place-based goals and things like that. So for me, it's looking at the total cost and the total benefit to you, and not just I'm procuring an insurance product here. What else can I get out of it?
Finally, the pandemic exposed many examples of really bad procurement.
In the scramble to get urgent medical supplies, PPE and ventilators ahead of the rest of the world, which was also trying to do the same thing, good procurement practices were not always followed as they should have been. We now know about billions being wasted on equipment that wasn't up to scratch, contracts being handed to people with no experience of procuring medical equipment at all, and just constant delays. The government said that this is justified because of the urgent and unprecedented situation. But do you agree with that? What should we learn from this in order to be better prepared for the next unprecedented situation?
An interesting question. Personal view would be that it may have been unprecedented, but we should all have been aware. You know, a pandemic's been on the global risk report for years, probably over 10 years. It was inevitable that it was going to happen at some point. You know, history tells us that. But we, and that's the royal we, weren't necessarily prepared, which led to the picture that you've just painted, you know, the scrambling around trying to get PPE. I suppose, you know, bringing it back into my world, we should be planning better for this sort of thing and understand in advance what our supply chain is and what their capabilities are. And if it's planned out, then it's easier to deal with. And there'll always be bits that are unprecedented. It wasn't quite what we planned for, but you'll be more able to tweak the plans if you've got a plan in the first place. And it didn't feel as if we did have a plan. And you'd probably expect this from an insurer. You know, you should regularly scenario plan for the unexpected or unprecedented and be trying to think of what is it that's going to do us damage. And then once you know what that is, what can you do about it and where can we get the resources that we need and have your supply chain ready in advance? Now we would know that we need PPE and where we would go to get it and that sort of thing. So again, bringing it back to my world, it would be, and I accept that, you know, it's nowhere near a pandemic. You know, it would be surge capability or something like that. You know, once you've scenario planned and you're working out, right, what do we need to do, then work with your supply chain to plan out their support in advance, including the cost. And then that means that you're not in the position where people can basically charge what they want for the whatever it is that you're trying to get hold of. And it means you don't have to get into creating emergency supply chains at high cost, because you already know what you're going to do. I would also add, though, that to say some of the creativity involved in creating that PPE was excellent. So we would lose something like that. But the key here is about disaster scenario planning, because that is always going to save you in the long run.
That was my last question, and a huge thank you to you, Rod. That was really interesting to hear all of your perspectives as a private insurer and how you can and do help the public sector and help it to mitigate the risks that it faces. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks, Rod, for your insight into the risks local authorities are facing and the dangers in cutting their insurance premiums. Next, we're joined by Liz Sandwith, who's in conversation with Viv Russell.
Hi, Liz. Thanks for joining me today on Sit for Speaks. So to start with, would you like to tell our listeners about you and your role at the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors? And maybe you could tell us a little bit more about the Institute and what it does.
Absolutely delighted to join you today, Viv, and thank you for asking me. One of the things that the Institute is perhaps not very good at is short titles. So I am the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors UK and Ireland Chief Professional Practice Advisor. So as I said, lengthy title. What that means in reality is that I have responsibility for the technical guidance side of the Institute. I respond to technical queries, deliver presentations on hot topics to our members, and I collaborate with our colleagues in the policy team in relation to thought leadership research reports. I'm also responsible for our audit leaders membership group, and I arrange 2, sometimes 3 events every month with speakers on hot topics to help them make sure that they are across all of the new and emerging risks, which there are a lot of in the current climate. And I also have responsibility for our external quality assessments, which, in accordance with the IIA standards, it is a requirement for internal audit functions to have an external quality assessment at least once every 5 years. So the Chartered Institute covers the UK and Ireland, and we are the sole voice in relation to internal audit. We're the only membership body that deals solely with internal auditors. We're also aligned an affiliate of the IIA Global membership body, which has over 190,000 members across the globe, and we all work, so all of us are required to conform with the International Professional Practices Framework, which includes the standards, the code of ethics, the core principles, and the definition of internal audit.
As you know, we've just published a major report, Internal Audit Untapped Potential is the title. And so this is looking at the current state of internal audit in the UK public sector. And so the research is based on over 800 responses to a survey we sent out to internal auditors and also managers of public sector organisations, so their clients. And we also carried out some focus groups and interviews. CIPFA believes that better internal audit means better public services. So it's essential we take time to examine internal audit and understand what's working well and what isn't. Could you tell our listeners how robust internal audit can actually improve the effectiveness and impact of public bodies, such as local authorities?
I know that we are looking at this from public bodies, local authorities, but I would say that what I'm about to say covers all sectors. Robust internal audit is a real asset to organisations. As internal auditors, we don't just follow rules, we have standards, and we are expected to apply those standards in our professional environment. We also have a mission, which is about enhancing and protecting organisational value by providing risk-based and objective assurance, advice and insight. And we rely on a framework of principles and standards to help us achieve this. We also have a definition, and we define internal audit as an independent objective assurance and consulting activity designed to add value and improve an organisation's operations. And it helps an organisation accomplish its objectives by bringing a systematic, disciplined approach to evaluate and improve the effectiveness of risk management, control and governance processes. And I guess maybe you're thinking, how on earth is that answering the question? But actually, it is providing that framework that is essential in order to be able to add value and improve public services, improve local authorities, and improve organisations in general in terms of work that internal audit does. So our primary role is around helping our board and our executive management to protect the assets, reputation and sustainability of the organisation. And I guess never has that been more important than over the last 2 years, where internal audit has been very much front and centre of an awful lot of organisations, including public sector, in terms of helping their organisations cope with the challenges of the pandemic. And they are still there as we move forward into the new challenges that 2022 brings. So what we need to do and how we do this and provide this robust assurance is we assess all the significant risks. So what we do is we look at the strategic goals and objectives of the organisation. We see whether all of the risks that would inhibit the organisation delivering its strategic objectives have been clearly identified, that management has put strong controls in place to mitigate those risks, and that management are reporting to the audit committee, the board, the CEO, the senior management team around those controls and whether they're being adhered to, whether they're working effectively, whether there has been any controls that have failed and what management are doing around that. And we will provide an assurance to the audit committee in particular and to senior management around the effectiveness of the controls. And that's how the control has been designed. Is it at the right point in the process? And is it effective?
So the CIPFA report identifies many areas where things are working pretty well. Internal audit is making a good contribution to the effective management of the organisation. From the responses we received, 88% of clients felt that internal audit was already making a strong contribution to the organisation. And that's up from only 60% who said the same thing back in 2008. What are your thoughts on the reasons for this improvement, and what do you think is going on that's led to that, and how can we measure the impact of internal audit?
I think that's a really good question, and I think if we cast our minds back, it's been since 2008, it's been a fairly bumpy 14 years. We've had the financial crisis, and it took organisations a long time to sort that out. There was lots of changes in regulations. And now we find ourselves coming out of the pandemic and coming into all of the challenges created in relation to macroeconomic, geopolitical risks, etc., brought about or exacerbated perhaps by the war in Ukraine. I think it's worth bearing in mind that perhaps unlike our colleagues in external audit, we look beyond financial risks to look at the wider issues facing an organisation, things like its reputation, its growth, its impact on the environment, and the way it treats its employees. So you will find internal audit looking at things like an organisation's diversity and inclusion programme. You will see internal audit asking of senior management and the audit committee, and sometimes even the board or the council, what are they doing around climate change? How is that on their radar? What targets have they set? Are they aware of the regulatory obligation? I think that internal audit has certainly moved forward in helping its organisations to succeed. You know, if I can wind my clock back way beyond 2008, and, you know, in those days, it was very much a tick box profession. And I'm talking beyond, way back beyond 2008. We have now got to a state where internal audit is much more around collaborating, communicating, coordinating, and aligning ourselves with the business as a whole. So that could be your risk function, your data protection officer, your senior management team. And collectively and collaboratively, then, we are all working for the good of the organisation as a whole and helping the organisation to succeed. And we do this usually through a combination of assurance and consulting. Sometimes we will undertake a series of assurance engagements where we will look, as I mentioned earlier, around control and risk and provide an assurance as to whether the area that we are auditing is conforming with policies and procedures and has strong controls in place and has identified risk. So part of that assurance work will involve telling managers and organisations generally, senior management, how well their systems and processes are working and have they been designed to keep the organisation on track to achieving its strategic goals and objectives. And then we will offer some consultancy work. So perhaps when people were talking initially around climate change, it was about, well, what do we need to do in this space? How can we mitigate the risks of not achieving the targets? And then internal audit might have been involved and provided feedback around some of the regulatory obligations and what the organisation needed to do to achieve its goals in that space. So real-time assurance and other new initiatives have been very much front and centre of everything that internal audit has been doing over the last 2 years. And I think that has influenced some of the responses to the survey, because perhaps suddenly people are remembering things that internal audit have done that are very fresh in people's minds. And we've also helped management with regard to some of the resource challenges. So again, both the public sector and local authorities, I'm familiar with internal audit being deployed into other areas of the business over the last 2 years.
Thanks, Liv. That's really interesting insights into how the internal audit function has changed in recent years. Really fascinating. The CIPFA report also highlights some areas where internal audit is not being allowed to maximise its full potential. In your experience, why does internal audit sometimes not get the recognition it deserves in organisations, and what can we do about that?
I think what we can do about it is raise the profile. So internal audit can be often seen as an area where there is no real engagement with the organisation. So you don't see internal audit unless they're doing an audit engagement in your area. So I think internal audit needs to raise its profile, be out there talking to the business and making sure that we are talking risk and control and process, and also calling out some of the new and emerging risks. So I think, as I've mentioned briefly, the last 2 years have been a real opportunity for a lot of internal auditors to move forward and look at new risks that they haven't done before. But equally, there are some internal audit functions that are in their comfort zone and don't necessarily want to take on new challenges. So for them, the last 2 years has been probably very challenging, and perhaps they have withdrawn more into their comfort zone than they might have done in the past. So I think it's about encouraging internal auditors to be brave, encouraging them to go out and talk to people across the organisation and to see really how they can support an organisation as it moves forward into the future with all of the new risks and challenges.
You've mentioned the current political and economic climate, and of course, the future is looking very uncertain at the moment. We've got soaring inflation, cost of living crisis, which is going to be felt by many households across the country, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight to any of this. Obviously, the public sector is not immune to inflation pressures. So how can governance, accountability and, of course, internal audit help to protect essential public services during these challenging times and mitigate any risks they may face?
I think that one of the things that we absolutely should be doing is being very clear as to what are the key risks facing the organisation. So if you're a local authority with a direct labour force, then have you got issues around raw materials? Where are your supplies coming from? Are we appreciating the challenges around the supply chain? What can we do to rethink our supply chain? Can we look elsewhere? Can we rejig our procurement model, perhaps, in terms of addressing some of those issues? There are also issues around people, organisations, workforces are moving, are doing things differently, perhaps don't want to come back into the office. What are the challenges there? And what can internal audit do? Some of the work that internal audit can do there is we can't conjure up people for the organisation, but we can look at what are the key processes, can we make things more efficient to help the organisation achieve its objectives, perhaps when they have less resources than they want. I think internal audit for me has three skills it brings to this. We have hindsight, so we can look back, we can learn from what we've done in the past and make sure that we are communicating that across the business. We can look at the here and now. What are the things that we are seeing in the organisation? What's good? What's not so good? What can we improve? What can we make more efficient? So that would be insight. And then we've got foresight, looking ahead, talking to people in other public sector organisations, local authorities, looking at the Institute. What is the Institute saying to people, looking down the track? What are the risks coming down the track? So things like inflation, cost of living, what's that going to do? It's going to increase costs. It's potentially, in local authorities, going to cause people not to be paying their council tax or their business rates because they haven't got the funds. What's the impact of that on the organisation? Have we done stress testing recently? How can we use that to help shape the future and to rethink what we need to do and perhaps reprioritise some transformation projects that we were hoping to achieve?
Staying with the topic of the future for this final question, the report recommends that internal audit needs to keep up with the changing needs of the organisation if it's to stay relevant and impactful. So there's areas such as cybersecurity, climate change, which you've already mentioned, and big data. These could be high impact areas for internal audit in the future. How can internal audit contribute to these growth areas, and what do you think are the major challenges for the profession in the near future?
I think that some of the real challenges are around upskilling. So as an institution, Institute, we have produced some thought leadership research reports around climate, around financial sustainability, around cybersecurity, and around culture. And I think that some of our colleagues in internal audit functions need to realize that where they don't have the skills and where they need to upskill to be able to provide the assurance to their organization. And we hopefully do that through our thought leadership reports. We also do it through technical guidance. The capability of the internal audit function to deliver the tasks, and of course the capacity, have they got enough people to do that, are some of the challenges. And looking to the future, so we are prepared for what's coming down the track, rather than reacting in the here and now, I think are really important things and are going to be absolutely key as we move through 2022, which potentially is only going to get more and more challenging.
Thank you for your time, Liz. It was really great to hear your insights into the state of internal audit and its future potential and how it can contribute to best public services. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Viv, for inviting me. And I'm looking forward to collaborating with SIPFA in delivering against this report and hopefully working to really deliver an internal audit fit for the public sector. Thank you.
That was Liz Sandwith from the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors explaining why internal audit is vital to the public sector. That's it from us for this episode, but we'll be back soon with more guests, more questions, and more things that public finance professionals need to know about. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.